Okay, we're going to just launch into this, spend some time this afternoon, and have a little bit of a question answer thing. So I wanted Aaron to, first of all, I wanted him to share some of his story and to answer this question, what are some of the key ingredients? They have such a life-giving wholehearted church and ministry, very just passionate and alive. And so I wanted them to share a little bit of their story about how they came into having the church and just some of the elements that have been, what have been the key things to having this wholehearted, like, core group that you have and the passion that's there. So, yeah, so that would be a good place to start, and then we'll get into a few other things.
Okay. We just kind of feel family. Is it okay if we just sit?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Perfect. I think we have some. Yeah, we'll talk about our history and our culture and core values and just kind of talk about that. Are you guys all in leadership? A form of leadership in the church? Just, oh, okay. All right. Last night, it's amazing the hotel beds are getting smaller and smaller. I thought it was two queen beds, but there was like a twin or something we were sharing, it felt like. So now all of a sudden she wants me to be closer to her. And last night she's like, every time I even turn, you were just right there. I was like, yeah, baby, snuggle up.
Does
having
anything to do with those four children that
were in
bed with you?
They were... Could be, but yeah. Hadassah was with us part of the night, so... and I don't know what history you remember from the last time I was here, so I'll just kind of give an overview, a bird's eye view of that, not to repeat if you were here, but not to exclude you if you weren't. So, 11 years ago in September, I was an atheist up to that point. So 11 years ago in September, I had an encounter with the Lord, and without believing in him, without believing in signs, wonders, miracles, believing against manifestations, gifts, tongues, things like that, I was actually baptized in the Holy Spirit and had a power encounter that was crazy and yet awesome all at the same time. I hadn't cried in a few years. And so it came with a lot of weeping, and I just hit the floor, and God rewired all of my thought process, all of my thinking, all of my theology, everything, and just in a moment. And so then Nicole and I, we were married at that point, but it was a pretty gruesome marriage up to that point, because I waited till a year that we were married, because I knew if I told her before that, she wouldn't have married me. So I told her that I had cheated on her while we were engaged, and I was a womanizer, and just a very perverted, hurt, angry, full of hatred, wasn't a believer, was abusive. So just months before that, we're praying, I just simply said this thing, God, if you're real, I want to feel you. I want to cry. That's kind of a specific thing I asked. So then it brought us to that encounter, and then about a month between those two, between the prayer, then we went to a thing called Weekend to Remember. It's by Family Life Ministries, James Dobson. It was a marriage conference, a weekend. And there were some onion layers being peeled off at that thing. And I just remember two sessions. One was we had to give each other a letter from each other, a love letter. And that was really moving to receive that letter. But then they give and share the feelings that I was having. So then there was another one called Receiving Your Spouse as a Gift from God. And so there were some things there. And then once I got hit with the Holy Spirit and just totally waxed when I wasn't expecting it, was just like a huge thing. So then we came back. That was in Indiana. So when we came back to Ohio, we were just there visiting. And we came back, and it was crazy. I remember, I wept for a week. I couldn't talk about this thing for a long time. Still, most of the time in many settings, I still just can't speak about all the details. So I just remember telling my dad, man, I get it. I see the vision for the future of the church. I think, So her and I, she was already serving. She was kind of running the kids' ministries at my dad planted a church in 1998, December of 1998. And we were dating. She started coming to church with me there. I attended. I played the drums, but I wasn't a believer. And I was mostly hungover every single Sunday morning playing the drums. Just a partier. And so we have that experience, and then I went all in. So I just totally sold out. I lost all of my friends. I quit partying, quit doing the stuff with the firefighters I was doing back then, and became a great husband, eventually an amazing dad. So, and I brag about that because of who I used to be. Like, I'm bragging about God on that, not myself. Because without him, I was hideous. I was a heathen, and just really, really, really bad. So we went all in. We started with the youth ministry, right? Is that what we started to do together? We had two kids in the youth ministry. Let me fast forward through some of this history. I'm sorry, I started getting really detail-oriented if you knew this story already. Youth group blew up. We went from two kids to 15 kids to 30 kids to 60 kids to 80 kids. And it was amazing. That was over about 3 to 5 years. We started doing life groups. We started small group, home groups. We launched that in our church. That really took off. We started raising up leaders for that. I started helping out with the budget. We started doing like things for the building project. I ended up running that project. What else? You were still doing the kids stuff. I had my own small group as well with about 30 guys in it. Most of them convicts and felons and addicts. It just happened that way. I thought I'd reach like firefighters and policemen, and then all these cons just started showing up, and it was pretty amazing. A lot of alcoholics, and then from there they split off and did a Celebrate Recovery that was reaching like 50 guys a week, and there was just a bunch of cool things going on at once. Then all of a sudden my mom got diagnosed with cancer, and we built our new building, our new church that we're in now, and then in the process, that's when she died. We were just about 2 months shy of finishing that project, and she passed away. I didn't get to see it. So then my dad went on like a leave of absence. We kind of gave him some time to figure out what he wanted for the church, what direction, what was going to happen. At that time, Nicole and I were still pastoring the youth. That was a main focus that we had. But then we were also doing like assistant, associate pastor roles, which means you do everything that needs to be done that's not being done. So we were just pitching in, and so my brother and I stepped up to the plate. My brother was a huge help during that season as well. And then 4 months after my mom died, my dad tells us he's going to get remarried. And so, you know, fighting to keep the family together, the church together, it was just kind of a mess, to be honest with you. And then he came back, you know, and kind of started showing up. Like, he literally, like, would leave it a month at a time. And I'm like, man, I didn't even want to be a Christian, let alone a pastor. So then we became the interim pastors. And then through some counsel, my dad had a dream. There was a prophetic word, kind of a mentor pastor of our church, or like a kind of an apostolic father or friend, at least, of our house. He just kind of had some confirmations from my dad. So my dad then said, listen, I can't pastor without your mom. And this was her and I's thing. We planted this together. I can't continue it without her. So we're like, okay. He said, all the growth from the church has come from you. It's mostly your age of people coming here now. I want you to pastor. So we agreed to it. And we kind of did this conditional acceptance to the Lord. Do you remember that? In the hot tub, we were like, if we can have fun. I remember saying that. If it's fun. And, you know, we put a couple other fleeces out. So, you know, there was another one. We won't go there. We then took over, right? And I remember just doing an assessment of our church. I was like, okay, because let me backpedal a minute. I'm sorry, I go all over the stories. So, okay. I think I shared this once, but this is valuable information moving forward. When your dad, and you, many of you are family in here, and one of the things I had to get over, and I had to do it the hard way because I didn't choose to do it the easy way, was in family, and when you're really close, you see all the flaws. You see all the mess. You see all the imperfections. You see all the mistakes. So I saw everything my dad and mom weren't doing, and I saw all the things that were preventing the church from growing, and I didn't see what they were doing. And so, like, I remember my mom saying, she was like, Aaron, if you don't learn this, God's going to teach you it. And when he teaches you something, it's not as easy if you just learn it on your own. So I didn't believe her. But it was true. So I remember just being really dishonoring and just kind of like if you could imagine a really rebellious 17-year-old living in your home, which some of you may have been through that. And I was that 17-year-old. I was also like that equivalently in the spirit realm and in church leadership. So I was like this rebellious teenage saved person, you know, like in spiritual maturity, who thought he knew everything and knew it all and knew everything more than the parents, and they couldn't teach me anything, you know. So I went through that process, and he had me call that same pastor that helped us through some things in the church where I was saved and set free. And I just remember that guy, you know, his name is Mike Henson, just a really amazing man of God. He's like, Aaron, he's like, your job, and at that time, again, assistant pastor, he's like, your job is to push things. Your job is, as a youth pastor and assistant pastor, is to push the envelope on things. He said, but you can't fight for everything. He's like, you got to pick and choose your battles. He said, the other thing is, you know, he explains, God puts your parents in as pastors, not you. They're the captains of that ship, and this is a big ship, and it doesn't turn fast. And he's like, you can literally only pick about 2, 3, maybe 4 things a year to really fight for. He's like, other than that, you just got to let it go and trust God. And he's like, but you need to honor your parents. And he recommended me to read a book by John Bevere. Sorry. Called Bait of Satan. And the big picture of that book is how David honored Saul, you know, the man who was trying to kill him. But he was the rightful king coming up, you know, and if he can honor Saul like that. So I just had this revelation that my dad was nowhere close to Saul, you know, and if David can honor Saul like that, what am I doing? So what I didn't know was for the next 2 years, that would have been my mom's last 2 years on earth. So I got to finish so strong with her. You know, we totally sold out to honor. And this isn't hurt that's coming out. It's in those moments of trial. It's in those moments of breakthrough that you really think it's just for you. But it set up the entire future for our church. So what we realized was we were sowing into the honor. We were sowing into the culture that was eventually going to be created and set forth as a precedence for Nicole and I to take over. So it came as a son, you know, in the spirit, and a son in the natural, to submit to a mom and a dad and not focus on their faults, but focus on what God was doing and trusting in that process. So in that whole picture then, it set up this huge culture that we now benefit from. Because my mom and dad were persistent on us getting right, you know, and nudging us into that, but also us then realizing it, even though we went the hard way, understanding what submission really looked like. You know, the Bible has a verse that says that we want to celebrate with his resurrection, but what we always leave off there is that we want to also join him in the suffering. You know, and I'll be honest, some of this stuff isn't easy. Some of it comes with a price. It costs something. You know, going to the promised land costs something. It comes with a cost. And I agree that grace, you know, and salvation isn't earned. I understand that. We don't have to earn miracles and healings. Jesus paid the price for that. But when we're contending for something, we're contending for a community to be transformed, a church to be, have a culture, it comes with a cost. And that's a thing that kind of the Culture of Honor book really doesn't paint, is that, yeah, this appears really easy, but when you're going relational into something, it actually is really hard, because now you have to be courageous to confront the things that are hard to confront, and coming together like this is really hard. So a lot of our plowing and a lot of our sowing into that culture was actually us learning it firsthand and us kind of surrendering and submitting to my heathenism, my rebellion, and my immaturity and all that, and actually just realizing, okay, God, this is you. So anyway, my mom passed away. Dad gave us, handed the church over to us, and it's been amazing ever since. But I do remember when we were officially set in as pastors, which will be January. In January, it'll be 5 years that we've been doing this. And so it's been a wild ride. It's been crazy. But there's something to know, and I feel you guys have that here, and I think you guys are, I think you know you're good, but I think you're better than you even think you are. I think your culture and what you have here is better than you even realize. I think you know it's good, but it's even better than that. And it's kind of fun as you have new families coming in, and it's like the people that have never went outside of here sometimes don't realize how good you have it. Like, you think the grass is greener, but really it's not. It's really amazing here. And we've been looking forward to coming here ever since Rick sent out the invitation. We love it here. We've been here separately. It's like, oh, we get to go together. So, and that's kind of like with us. And Nicole, last time she was here, she brought Christy. And like everything, so when we took over the church, we're like, well, what's it need? What do we feel God wants to do through Upper Room in Tipp City, Ohio? We had to come through a process to realize we're not Bethel. We're not IHOP. We're not the ramp. We're not this. We're not that. I'm not Leif Hetland. I'm not him. So I had to come through this like journey and maturity and knowing who I was, knowing who we were, knowing who Upper Room is. So we just said, okay, what do we feel God wants to breathe? Who are we? What's our identity as a church? And we're like, we want to be known. We've always been known for love, signs and wonders, healing. You know, we really wanted a culture of healing, culture of honor and family. That was some of the things that we really wanted to contend for. So for the next 3 years, that's what we went after. Balancing out word and spirit, balancing out what the Lord is wanting to do through us. And it was a journey. I'll be honest, there's nothing harder that we've done in ministry. And the last, my mom's death, my mom's, all the journey we've been through has not compared to us trying to create a culture of honor and a culture of family. It's something that was the hardest thing we've ever done. It's a something that every relationship was challenged. It's something that, it was crazy. But it's something we would do all over again in an instant, in a heartbeat. Because for me, I'll just be honest. I sometimes say the stupidest things with a microphone in my hand. I do. I say sometimes like bad words and all kinds of things. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I have a really good filter when I travel out, but when I'm not traveling out and I'm home, I'm like, I don't curse, but I'm just saying, like,
saying you don't need to share the examples.
I'm not going to. Listen, I work 40 hours a week in a firehouse, all right? And if you've ever heard the saying, cuss like sailors, work at a firehouse, all right? The one girl, yeah, she knows. So, like, my boss, I don't think he can say two sentences in a row without an F word in one of them. Like, no joke. And at least two or three in one sentence. So, sorry. All right. She's like, this is why she's here. My point in saying that is, I don't want to be somewhere, and I don't want to be a part of something where I can't be me. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm not willing to give up flesh and God to correct me and like, even people to you know, what's that? How do you word that in Bible language? Above reproach. Yes. Came to me. So anyway, like, I get all that. But at the same time, like, God wired me to be a little wild, all right? I was wild in the world. I want to be wild in the kingdom, all right? And I want to be righteous and holy and all that things. Okay, I get that. But, like, I'm a wild man. I'm crazy. I love to have fun. I love to be real. I love to be transparent. I love to be vulnerable. I love to share with you when we're having issues. Like, we share with our church. We share the whole story about how I was abusive. We share it with our kids. I don't want to be a part of something where I can't be open, transparent, and vulnerable, and allow you actually into that process. So, like, we had a really trying year a year or two ago, and we just let people in the process. I don't want to be a part of a system where I can't share that. I grew up in a church and a religion that hid everything, you know, and they hid who they really were, and the pastors had to be perfect and had their suits on up on the podium, sitting in their fancy chairs, and it's just not me. You know, I grew up in that, and it was destructive. It was hypocritical, and then everybody else tried to measure themselves to be as perfect and sinless as the pastors were portraying to be, when it wasn't even true. I lived in a pastor's home. My grandpa was the bishop for the denomination in Ohio. Like, it was all around me, all my uncles, cousins, they're all still pastors in that denomination, and it's not tangible, it's not practical. So I'm not perfect. I do mess up, I do sin. And, you know, so some of the things that we contend for is that a culture can actually be free and we can help each other through those messes when and if they do come. You know, not every marriage in our church is perfect, but we're hoping that we're open enough in our church that people will come to us, and a young couple will come to us when they're having trouble, and we can actually help them walk through that. Because now we're approachable because we're vulnerable. So those are some of the things that we've really went for, is a culture of freedom. And again, we, you know, like I said, we're not super left side here and like greasy grace, hyper grace over here. We were there. We went through a little season of that. And we went through a season of legalism over here. And we've realized, like, the center of that is God's love. If you obey me, you know, if you love me, then you obey my commands. So we've kind of realized, like, okay, there is a kind of a tension in that. But it's in the center found in his love. So anyway, some of the cultural things that Rick's talking about is, you know, oftentimes when people come in, they'll feel the love. They'll feel the family. They'll feel a sense of man, these people got each other's backs. That's where I want to be. I've done firefighting. My whole family's military. Like, you know, when you're in the trenches, when I'm in a fire with somebody, I've got to know they're not going to run out that door and leave me in there alone. I got to know that I'm not in there with some weak guy who's going to just get scared and bolt on me. I got to know that we've got each other's backs and we're going to push each other to the limits to get what needs to get done so that when we can get home safe to our families and we can have fun in the process and have a brotherhood. And that's kind of my parallel to the kingdom is, like, I want to go to battle. I want to see this world turned upside down. I want to see lives transformed. I want to see people encounter the presence of Jesus the way that I did. I want to see people meet such a powerful God that in their heroin addiction, in their homosexual lifestyle, in these crazy bad things, in this, you know, abusive relationship, that they get so transformed by God's presence that they're led into such an encounter in a place of security and a place of freedom, that they encounter such a God that they're transformed in a moment. And then in the process, when we start to slip back into our man, when we start to slip back into the pre-saved kind of temptation, that we're there to sharpen iron, we're there to brush them off, we're there to say, no, keep looking forward, it's worth it. And so in that, I need to make sure that people have got our backs instead of stabbing us in them. I want to make sure that, like, we actually like hanging out with the people that we're doing kingdom with and that we're doing life with. I love hunting. I love talking about cars and stuff like this. So it's not a requirement to go to our church to be a hunter, have tattoos, or, you know, talk about cars. So a lot of our people have a lot of tattoos. So anyway, but it helps when you know that people have your back and you actually love each other and you have fun being around each other. And that's probably what people feel when they come in. Like Micah, like, we're best friends. When we came here 2 years ago, her and Christy are super close. Micah and Meredith and us and Josh and Angie, they're there, our other pastors. They lead our SOZO and counseling ministries and pastoral care. We went to Redding, we stopped through at Napa, we went to San Francisco for 2 days, like, and we had a blast. We're laughing. We still sing group texts of, like, inside jokes, just funny things, because we actually know that each other's got each other's backs. Let me just, I'll end with this, and then it's Nicole's turn. You know what's funny? When we're alone, like, she talks way more than I do. I don't talk much. So sonship is this. Sonship is meaning. It's like, you'll take a bullet for me even if it's from me. That's true sonship. Because occasion, on an off day or when I'm not full of Jesus like I should be, there might be bullets flying from me. Could be accidental. It could be I'm just a jerk that day. We all have those days. I'm not, you know, I try not to. I try to stay so full of Jesus and his love that I'm not like that. But on occasion, I am. And that's the thing. And it's the same with them. Like, we're calling each other out on stuff. Like, man, that hurt me when you did that. You know, Micah, I'll just share a tangible example. Micah, he's launched his own ministry, he and his wife. It's called Love Pursuit International. Super proud of them. Have encouraged us as part of their dream. We've dreamed this together, and we're helping them kind of launch out to do some evangelism and crusades and different cool things. And, you know, we got a mutual friend, Wilson Cochran, from Cincinnati Vineyard Northwest. And I see Wilson on Instagram post a newsletter that he got from Micah. And I had never seen this newsletter, weren't a part of it. I'm on Micah's board, you know. And I was like, oh, you got a newsletter? What's up with this? So I texted him. I was like, hey, man, I feel excluded from this process. I feel excluded in your life. What's going on, you know? We should probably have a chat. So we were traveling together the next weekend, and we had an hour and a half drive, and we just talked the whole time, sharing each other's feelings, sharing each other's heart. Like, it made me hurt, man. It hurt me when I saw Wilson post this, and I didn't even know you were doing a newsletter, and I didn't get one. Like, I kind of felt left out. I feel, you know, I feel a little jealous, too. You know, just sharing raw feelings. And he's like, oh, man, I'm so sorry. And, you know, just, he's like, here's what I thought behind it. Here's what I was doing. I didn't mean to make you feel this way. And he's like, but while we're on this, here's how I'm feeling this. So that's this. That's the culture we have. I'll let Nicole share.
One time, we were at a school ministry.
Oh, boy.
And I was supposed to speak, too. And it got to be, we were done at 8:30, and it got to be 8:20. And then he let me talk.
It started at 6.
I was like, oh, my gosh, why did I come? So I think for me, it was just, I mean, he explained all of the, like, he explained it so well, all the details and things, but just as he's processing all this, as you sit there, I mean, for me, I'm thinking, you know, as senior leaders, that's, I'm not saying it's not running through everyone else's mind all the time, but that this culture thing is just running through us all the time. It's like, we breathe it, we live it, we think about it constantly, we're like, always thinking ahead of, like, well, how do we need to address this area and things like that, and sometimes I think it's important for us to recognize, like, for all of the ones who are running with us in this, this is valuable because it's like, you know, you might sit there and be like, well, why, this is great news for Rick and Phyllis, but what, how does this help me? And I think as a family, for the culture, like, there is not one person that's going to walk through the doors and stay if they don't experience the tangible honor, the family. If they don't experience that when they walk in, they will walk back out because they can go to their job on Monday and feel disconnect, dishonor, and all those things. And so I think that it's so important to keep at the front of our minds that the reason that we talk so much, the reason that we desire it so much, the reason that we want this family culture, this culture of honor, this connection, this heart connection, this openness and honesty, the reason that we want all this is because we are to be set apart from what is experienced outside. And, I mean, you guys know, like, when you're out, like, we can go to Menards and experience dishonor. I can, you know, so I think, I just felt like saying, like, there is a reason. We're not just creating our own little bubble, and we want our bubble to be really great. That's not the purpose. The purpose is so that this becomes something that we walk out when we go out. The whole purpose in this, honestly, is to have something that's happening in here, but then it's happening in you so that when you go out, you're actually transforming your heavy culture, the thing that you're influencing. You know, like one of his brother Matt, the fire chief, he's picked up so much of what we've plowed for and taught and been in the church that he gets to take it into the fire department, and now he's activating the culture of honor at the fire department, and these guys are flipping out because they don't understand why they are being asked to share how they're feeling about something, you know? But people are being transformed that way. And I'm trying to think if there's any other examples of...
I'll elaborate on that. Matt and Matt said, I want to develop some core values for the fire department when they're posted at every station that we have. And one of the core values is culture of honor. There's five core values. One of them is culture of honor. And it's really cool. But he was telling, he got invited to this International Fire Chiefs Association, this small group of fire chief executives. And he applied for it. He's like, I'll throw my name in the hat. And he got accepted. And now our city's only 38,000 people. But he was, so the other chiefs in this same group, there's about 30 of them, I think, Orlando's fire chief, Washington, D.C., Las Vegas. There's so many. They're all over the country. Baltimore. You know, some of these guys have 1,200 firefighters or 3,000 firefighters. You know, so here's my brother. There's 42 of us. So, but the head of this organization, this small elite group that he's a part of, she's the fire administrator for Washington, D.C. He and her were having a conversation at one of the dinners one of the nights, and he flies all over the country, and they meet about once a quarter, and transforming the fire industry. He's sitting on an NFPA board as well and all these things. This little tiny fire chief from Troy, Ohio. And anyways, she's like, hey, Matt, I'm going to call up Matt Simmons, the fire chief of Troy, Ohio. I want him. Last night at dinner, he was telling me about this thing called the culture of honor. He's like, and how we value people and how we look at people beyond their job performance. And he's like, she's like, I want him to just kind of describe that to all of us in here. So here he is getting this voice. And again, it's just the thing I'll elaborate for her, you know, on what she was saying too, is people walk in this door. One of the things we try to do is make sure every person feels valued, feels heard, and somehow feels empowered. You know, especially as they're here, and what are you called to? What are your gifts? What do you dream about? So we try to meet with them. So anyway, Matt is just catching this. He's taking it out now. It's transforming fire departments along the nation. But that's the other thing. The culture of honor is a culture of honor. I love hearing Bill Johnson. I think it was his definition. Culture of honor is celebrating who someone is without stumbling over who they're not. So as people walk in, we actually celebrate who they are. We focus on who they are called to be. We focus on their destiny, not their history. We focus on their windshield, not their rearview mirror, you know, and moving forward. So just some things to add what she's saying.
Yeah, and I just think, I told him right before we started talking, I think, I don't know if we'll do it this weekend, but I think for you guys as a team or as a church even, just to sit and to dream about what dreams do you have for what, do you guys call it FOTB? What do you call your, okay. So what are you dreaming for your community? What ways can you meet the needs of the community? And as you're dreaming, you know, you're dreaming for that. And I think for us, one thing that I've seen too as a result of like the culture that we've sown into and things is, you know, obviously we don't focus on money, but what happens is people of high influence and, you know, who steward a lot of money or steward a lot of positions or have high influence in the community, they are attracted. We have a lot of very influential people that attend our church because the main thing, and it's not like we're a super wealthy church. We're not a mega church. We're none of those things. But the thing is that they come in and they feel like they can trust us to steward things well. And the ones who gave us the donations, it's like we trust you to steward this well. And it's because they've come in and they can sense it in the culture, they can sense it in the people and things like that. And that is how you have influence in your community. That is how you meet the needs of your community too. Is, you know, it's all, you know it. You go into a place, if you sense something like that's sketchy, you're not going to sew into that. You're not going to stick around. You're definitely not going to go all in. And so It's just all of this stuff is just setting you up for a foundation to where you get to catapult and you're attracting. People are literally attracted to you because they know that they can sense what's happening in the culture.
The Acts 2 church, remind me of that, Acts 2 church. But back to what she's saying, that anonymous donor, he met with me a few months ago and says, I have never been honored and valued the way you honor and value business people. So this is a business person who I informally ordained all of our senior advisory team, most of them are business owners, as informally installed them as cultural pastors. So I anointed them, I prayed for them, because they're the pastors touching people outside the church walls. So I look at them as ministry leaders, I look at them as pastors, even though they're not ordained inside the church, I ordain them to do the ministry outside the church. And I think that's how we kind of need to start looking at some teachers and nurses and all these people, like the tangible opportunities that they have. And I just told this person, I said, you know, a year or two ago, I said, man, I said, you're pastoring more people than I pastor. This is when I ordained them. I said, you know, you have people that buy from you, you have customers, you have vendors that you purchase from, and you have employees. I said, you reach 300 to 400 people every week on a weekly basis. I said, that's less people than I'm reaching directly on a weekly basis. Why do we not look at you as a pastor? You know, and I went through all of our business guys that way. And so we've kind of done that in our culture as well. I tend to believe this. I tend to believe that the Acts 2 church actually represented Christ in such a way that people wanted what was inside of that church and what the people had and who they were carrying. Yeah. Christ in them literally was the hope of glory. So if you read the end of Acts 2, we're called Upper Room because of the Upper Room experience, the Upper Room, the day of Pentecost. And my dad named the church after that. So if you read the end of Acts 2, it says they're in one mind, they're in one accord. Okay, so we have unity there. Then it says that, it goes on to say that they sold everything to actually devote themselves to each other and the work of the ministry. So then it goes in to say that they sold everything, they came together, and they devoted themselves to be in the temple daily and house to house daily. They were actually hanging out outside of the tabernacle, but they had a value of inside the tabernacle. So there's such a value to do life outside of here, but also meet corporately in here. Then it goes on to say that they celebrated, they had joy, and they gave generously. So they had a spirit of generosity. So here they are, they sold everything, they came together. Tell me that's not sacrifice. Anytime anybody tries to debate tithing with me, and they say, well, that was an Old Testament thing. Okay, let me bring you the New Testament way then. All right, Acts 2, they sold everything and gave it to the church. You want the Old Testament or the New Testament? You decide. It's between you and the Lord. So anyway, they tell me that's not a sacrifice. And then they met every day. Every day. Like, we start to whine if church goes past 1 o'clock on a Sunday, or they're singing the same song for 20 minutes. It's like, oh, geez, can't they move on? Buffet's going to get full, you know? So then it says after that, after all that happened, it says miracles, signs, and wonders accompanied them. Like, so here they have generosity, they have joy, they're hanging out together, they're doing life together, they're doing church together. Then it says thousands were added to them daily. So whatever it was they were doing inside here and in their homes, it made such an impact, and the presence was so strong, and there was such unity and honor. In my opinion, this is what I tend to believe. There was such a cool thing going on with that group of people, that core group of only started of 120, all right? Now, remember, it started with several hundred before that, and it trickled down, and it filtered down to 120 that actually met and waited on the Holy Spirit to be poured out. So 120, then it says thousands were added to them daily. And I know this about culture. Culture doesn't flock into something that they can just get at Cracker Barrel. Like, culture doesn't just flock into something that people talking bad about them and gossiping and discord and all these things. And that stuff happens at my work. Even though we got the culture of honor going on, Matt and I are there. We're two of the top leaders in the organization. There's still backstabbing. There's still people talking bad about each other. Some people just want to be back to Egypt where they know where their next meal's coming from. They like the slavery, all right? So it is hard to get people into the promised land when they're not used to that. But I'll say this. I tend to believe that Acts 2 had something so special. It was so life-changing. And it was so much unity and love and honor there that the people from the outside noticed it and wanted not just the presence, but also the people that were happening in there. That's my opinion about it.
I have three things that I thought of as he's talking. Number one, I think that the miraculous, the miracles, the signs, and the wonders, those are incredible, powerful, impactful ways to radically see someone have a great encounter. But that wears off. A lot of times, not saying the miracle stops, I'm saying, but the impact from that wears off, you know? There has to be something that's still drawing them in. And if it's a culture, you know what I'm saying? So it's like they can experience the miracle, but if the culture is still not backing it up, you're gonna start to see it trickle away. So that's just another, I think that's just another point for the importance of the culture. That was one thing. The second thing was, we have people that will drive, I think our farthest is like an hour and 30 minutes. They drive. We have another one that's like almost 2 hours, I think, that comes every once in a while. But like, they'll drive to our place because of what they feel when they walk in. The culture that's there, the love that's there, that's all those things. So I just say, like, because I know you guys are kind of out in the middle of nowhere land, but I just declare that distance and all of that is not a hindrance, but that they come and they sit in a culture that they can't find anywhere else. And they will come for that. People will drive for that. We know it personally. We experience it. I mean, we live literally 1 minute down the road. Thank you, Jesus. But people will come to it if it's something they can't experience anywhere else. And then the last thing is I know you guys know this, but just to reiterate, like, if you have an issue with someone, go to them. Just go to them. Don't even question yourself and it's, oh, I'm just being a baby about it. No, just like let them know. Like, hey, I felt blank when this happened. That's all you have to say. I cannot reiterate that enough. I am a very non-confrontational person. I would rather just let it be gone and not confront it. But I'm just telling you, like, every single thing, it's very biblical. Go to the person. Just let them know that you're hurt. It's so important.
Yeah, Matthew 18:15 is the algorithm to working out an issue and an offense or anything. If somebody has an offense, if you have an offense with somebody, go directly to that person alone. If that doesn't work, bring a witness or two in. If that doesn't work, bring the elders or the church leaders or the pastor in. And if that doesn't work, then dust your feet, basically. So it's like, listen, we got to work this out. And if these series of things don't, now I'm going to create some healthy boundaries and wait for you to be ready to work it out. That's the thing. What was the first thing you said? What was the number one?
Miracles.
Yeah. What happens when the goosebump wears off? What happens when that knee healing that got the person into the church is healed? I mean, think about the lepers that were healed. How many returned back to Jesus? So, and then it's like, where were the others thinking, you know, Elijah? It says it wasn't the wind, it wasn't the fire that brought him from the cave. It was a still soft voice. There's got to be something about, I love all the other stuff. Like, we love miracles. We love healings. We see some radical stuff on a pretty regular basis. But we can't surround ourselves by worshiping the miracles and forget about worshiping the miracle maker. Like, that, we have to be centered around Christ. Like, he has to be planted in this thing, in everything I do, in every group I start, we're doing this thing for millennials now. It's blowing up. We're planting Jesus, and we're gathering around that to see what he wants to do and how he wants to reach them. And we're having like 40 millennials show up at once a month gathering just for fun. No kids allowed. Like, no kids. Because we know that this group won't come if there's kids here, even if some of them have kids. So anyway, and we always joke around, we're like, if we can find babysitters for our 4 kids, you can find babysitters too. But anyway, it's like, plant Jesus, and then we grow from that. So many ministries, they want to start this program and build a ministry on a concept or a program or or this fad, you know, on this thing. And it's like, then eventually, if I had to entertain people to get them here, I'm going to have to entertain them to get them to stay. Members come and go, but families stick together. Like, divorce is no longer in our language. We haven't used divorce since the day I got saved. Like, it's not in our vocabulary anymore. Like, we did a thing called death do us part. Like, we're in this. We're covenant. And unfortunately, the culture doesn't feel the same way about relationships anymore. But that's how we feel in our church. Like, we're in it. Whether or not you agree with that, when you say you're a member, when you come in and say you're family, we have this family wall and paint your picture up. It's like, when you put a stake in the ground and you say you're going to own this place, it's yours. You're not renters here, you're owners here. We were at Beth, the leaders advance, in the Q&A, they were talking about the difference of renters and owners. It was amazing. I think it was Chris saying that. It was like, oh, whoa, man, owners really look at things way different than renters. Renters won't pick up that piece of trash that's on the, you know, foyer floor. They won't wipe up that water around the sink in the bathroom. But an owner, if this is my house, yeah, I'm doing that. So that's what we're trying to establish now. We're kind of even using that language of owners. Like, we're family. Members might come and go, but families, we stick together. Even if you don't like that annoying cousin, like, you're stuck with them. So now we actually got to make it work and enjoy the process. So that's how we say, we're like, you stuck with us. Yesterday, Christy, who was here with Nicole the last time, she just got married a half hour ago, about an hour ago. So to a guy named Christopher. So they came over to the house yesterday, and kind of a last minute thing. They were going to wait till May, and they're like, everything's just falling into place. We're just getting married this weekend. So if you didn't get a chance to know her, you'll know that's not out of the norm for her. So but she's doing phenomenal. So Christopher and Christy, they came over yesterday, and we blessed them. We prayed for them, and we just spent a little time with them. And I was like, Christopher. He's like, well, you have four daughters? I was like, Christopher, if you're marrying her, you're marrying us. You should know this about us. He's like, oh, I will. So anyway, I was like, you're marrying us. This is we're family. And so that's just part of it too. Like, we're choosing this. I want to touch on one more thing, is like our focus on family. The church family is like essential. But, like, we're moving into this new hunger to see families and marriages not just survive, but thrive. Sorry. This is par for the course with me, just so you know. When you pray for an encounter to cry, anytime the presence comes on you, you bawl like a little baby. So, you know, where are the days of, you know, I'm not against this stuff, so don't. This works for us. I want you to know that. Like, if you have family going to other churches or whatever, I feel you guys have a really great culture here. We're not against it. Like, her parents don't come to our church. They go to a mega Methodist church. We may not see eye to eye on everything, but they do great things there. There is not a culture of family there. It's a 45-minute service. You're in and out. But they're reaching people that a lot of people can't reach, that we don't reach. So they're doing great. So I want you to know, like, this thing, this culture, everything we're talking about, works for us. So I'm not belittling or, you know, degrading any other thing or system or culture. But I'll just be honest with me personally, with my hunger for, like, to be a good husband. Like, what is it? What would it be to gain an entire mega church? Like, what would it to be to grow a church to 2,000 if I've got one of my daughters not serving the Lord? You know, where are the prophecies that say you're going to be the best mom that anybody's ever seen? Yeah, I believe in the prophecies to send people to Africa and all that. But what about the ones that say you're an awesome grandma? Like, what are the ones that are like, man, you were born to be a husband, to stand up for righteousness, and like Joshua says, for me and my house, you're going to serve the Lord. Like, where are the days of that? And I, you know, that's one of the things that we're focusing on right now in this season, is like really going after and contending for marriages, moms and dads, kids, generational blessings, legacies, and not just how many people, and now you got to hear me the right way in this, not how many people you can lead into a repeat after me prayer, but how many people can you father? Like, what is it
Yeah, for me, I don't count the miracles, but I've known over a few thousand healing miracles now. And what good is that if my kids see me being a jerk at home? Like, that number means absolutely nothing to them. It'd probably push them away from God if their daddy chose another healing over spending an evening with them. So for me, there's such a balance of both. We've talked to so many people, and there's so many that when you ask them, if you could do this all over again, would you do it? I'm talking top leaders and top streams. If you could do it all over again, if you could reach this amount of people, if you could do this, would you do it all over again? And I'll be honest with you, I've heard so many people say, I don't know. If you can't say yes to that, then why am I holding you as a hero? You've never heard any evangelist, any revivalist say that their regret was they spent too much time with their family. You've never heard one of them say that they spent too much time with their kids. They should have been doing more ministry. You've never heard one of them say, if it could have just done one more crusade. Every single one of them say, I wish I would have spent either more time with God, alone time with his presence, or more time with my family. Those are the two things I've asked so many, and I'm not going to tell you names. I'm not going to tell you who. I've asked so many, and I've talked to so many people who've talked to others, and it's that same thing. So I feel that we've got this ministry thing kind of jacked up in our culture, that we begin to worship the ministry, and we fall more in love with ministry than we are with our own wives. I realized I was married to ministry and Nicole was a mistress on the side. 2 years ago, it about cost us our marriage. We just got to the point where laying in bed, and it was a year ago. It was before I went to Colorado hunting. The night before I leave for Colorado, a year ago, October, we're laying in bed, and she asked me this question. Are we only married because we have kids together and a church together? At that time, we were just coexisting, both passionately pursuing the Lord and passionately pursuing people being transformed by his love. Righteous things, right? Not at the cost of our marriage, not at the cost of our home, not at the cost of our kids. So I'll just be honest. I almost feel like I'm not the right person to listen to. I just think there's a new way we need to do this thing. There's a new way we need to do ministry, and it needs to be more of a lifestyle than it is a podium. And by that, there will be people with podiums. There's people in here that are called to be in podiums. Sorry, I need a Kleenex. We're getting to the emergency zone here. Oh, there we go. I've been preaching before, and I miss it, and it just, like, drips on the floor. Often, actually. Sorry. I'm real. I think that we just, like, we're trying to figure this thing out with Micah. Oh, thanks. We're trying to figure this thing out with Micah. Like, what does an evangelist look like inside the church? What's that look like? You know, I'm talking evangelist calling, like called to crusades. They've always been such a reject in the church, like, because they don't fit in. They need to be out. So what's that look like as we're blessing them going out, but also blessing them as they're in? Like, what's that look like for a missionary to have home here, a base here, but then they're being sent? Like, what's that? So we're trying to figure this thing out, and I'll be real. Like, we don't have it all figured out yet. Some of this is trial and error and trial and success and hoping we get success more than error. But I'll just be honest. Like, a lot of Mike and I's a lot of our conversations are based on, like, are you worshiping how many people that you get into the kingdom more than you are time with your family? Like, these is real conversations that we're having hours at a time. And man, he came into such a crazy revelation. It transformed their marriage the last 3 months. And he too realized that he was loving ministry more than he was loving his home and his wife and his kids. So we're trying to figure this thing out. We know like some things that are wrong. We know there's some things that are right. We're trying to find that sweet spot on the bat and swing away. But I just, you know, I've heard this saying for so often, like, God's never asking us to sacrifice our family on the altar of ministry. And like, the beautiful thing about us coming with our family this time is, like, they have prophetic words for you. They have pictures they've drawn for you, because we're, like, activating. We want them to do this together. Like, and that's just the coolest thing. I think some of you were at Marion when I was there a year or so ago, and Chloe getting that picture and her coming with me, and she's my travel companion. Like, we take turns, we rotate them of who comes with me, and we're trying to figure this out. But I just, yeah. It's good. We're going to go into Q&A now. Thank you. No, thank you for pushing me that way. We needed that. I would just ramble, and I meant to do Q&A. So. She'll do these things. She'll be. It starts with this. Then it goes into. The word intentional. That's the answer. The word's intentional. And oftentimes worship looks different than what we think it does. So the word being intentional is, when I'm at home, I am checked in. When I'm at home, I'm not on my phone. When I'm at home, I'm not, let me take care of your problem. When I'm at home, it's like, kids, what do you want to do tonight? You know, when I'm on a date with her, it's all her. When I'm ministering, I was just at Ron Wilson's church, Northgate, that's the name. I was at Northgate, and I knew the kids were going to be home in like an hour window. Well, it was worship time, all right? But worship for me at that moment looked like me going into a side room, figuring out their Wi-Fi, and FaceTiming my kids as they just woke up from a Saturday morning sleep-in. Like, so for me, it's intentional. When I'm at work, I try to be a good employee, you know? When I'm at home, I try to be a good husband and a good dad. And what Adam's talking about, maybe I didn't formally say this, I'm a full-time firefighter, a full-time pastor, and then, you know, full-time dad, full-time husband. So I just try to balance it. Well, I think the better one to answer the question might be you. Am I balancing it well? I can say I'm doing this, but am I being successful at it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is the word intentional, and it's actually making your brain be where you are. I mean, he could sit there without a phone, or I could, or you could. We could all sit there without a phone, but are you really there? You know, I mean, how often are we driving in our car and our kids are yelling at us and it's like they're saying our name 5 times because we're not really there, you know? So I think that that's part of it too.
One of the hurtful things that I experienced is like, all of a sudden my kids realized if they called me dad multiple times, I wouldn't answer. But when they said the name Aaron, I was like, yeah. Checking in as dad, like. The other thing with intentional is we schedule in things. As we do a budget, we do a calendar. So we try to make sure we have one, if not two nights a week that are untouched. And we have some incredible leadership at the church that takes care of a lot that I can still work full time. Just so you know, like, my job is very flexible. So I do a lot of church-related things during my downtime at work, which is permissible. I'm allowed to do that. As well as our ministry, we have no full-time staff. Everybody is a servant, volunteer. We're just all in it because we have the heart for it. Many of us have spouses or have a full-time job where we can do that. I'm not against full-time ministry at all. I'm not against, you know, I don't want to muzzle the ox and double portions. They do double honor. But the thing is with me is, like, they take care of a lot. But we schedule in things. So, and also we have some things that go untouched. So every Friday morning, it's my only day off from the fire department. I work Monday through Thursday, 4 10-hour days. On Friday mornings, that's my off day.
every Friday morning, I take one of the girls out on a date, and I take the girls to school every Friday morning. So I rotate the girls. So Chloe's turn was Friday. I took her to breakfast, and then I go pick the rest of the girls up and take them all to school. That's every Friday. I don't schedule anything around that. If I do, I try to make it up on another day. So we do things like that. We schedule in a date. We try to get one date in a month at least. Time's up. Next question, please. Just kidding. We try to schedule like a weekend, if not like 3-4 day trip away a year. Just her and I. We go to Cancun. We go to Belize. Like, we do something fun, all right? We get, like, I'm a super deal finder. And so I get on Groupon. We have air miles. Like, we are, like, budgeting to try to figure this thing out. So we try to, like, get away. Group text. So we try to get away because we want, like, you, even though some people may disagree with this, we were married before we had kids, and we want to be married long after our kids are gone. And if we're not healthily married, we're probably not going to be that healthy of parents. So we try to make sure, like, we invest a lot in us to make sure, like, we're fun to be around if you're a little kid and that we're really, really in love. And so we try to cultivate that and make sure we're in love and we're emotionally connected and we communicate really well if we're meeting each other's needs and things like that.
One other thing to go along with that is that I've noticed is, like, stewarding your time well. So, like, you know, if you have, like, let's just put it in regards to the church. If you know, like, for us, if we know we have life group on Wednesday night, okay, that night, not to be negative, but that night's shot. Like, we're not doing anything else. So what a lot of times we'll do is if there's someone we need to meet with, like if we need to have a meeting of some sort, we will plug it in on that same night. Because then that frees it up so that another night's not taken up. Like, so it's just like thinking, like kind of switching the way you think about things and looking and strategically putting meetings together, appointments together, those types of things together. We took the girls to the zoo thing, the Christmas thing, last night. Because we knew we liked to do that. We knew we were traveling kind of this direction. So we said, all right, let's just partner it up. And it's so it turns into a fun thing. So we're not just like, okay, well, now we have to find a different weekend to take a trip to Columbus, you know. So just being wise and stewarding that so that you're putting things together. We have a couple people that live far away, and I'll see their car at the church for, like, you know, hour and a half slots every day. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm thinking, why aren't they just putting all five of those things in one day? So they're just taking one day to get things, you know, so it's just like kind of rearranging your schedule so that you're actually making more with your time.
Yeah. Any other questions? Well, what are other questions? We won't leave it open-ended.
Children. And with your four, they're, part of the testimony is they're uniquely different, I would imagine.
They're totally different. Well, we did it kind of backwards. We decided to parent a bunch of teenagers before we had our own children. Yeah. We had two live with us for a couple years. So we learned a lot of what we didn't want in parenting. But no, Danny Silk, you guys familiar with Loving Our Kids on Purpose? Do you do that curriculum? He saved probably our home in helping us realize parenting can be fun and creative. So we probably don't have much more to add than what he does. I will say, you reach certain points, like Chloe. She's like, I hate Danny Silk. She'll literally say that. She's our oldest. She's 11. She's like, that Dan. She'll, yeah, 11 in February. That Danny Silk stuff. When you know, she'll like really badmouth him and dishonor him real well. But because she'd probably just rather be spanked, you know. But I will say, like, we've seen some parents kind of go over the top and never spank. So the way, like, you got to figure that out for your own home. But we realize, I'll share one story. Hadassah, she didn't sleep through the night for the first 2 years. There's not one night for almost 2.5 years she didn't sleep through the night. Not only that, she was up 3 times every night for 2.5 years. Our intercessors are praying. They're praying spirits out of our house. We're casting demons out of her. Like, you know, Chloe was sleeping through the night at like 8 weeks, you know. So we were kind of spoiled there, but Hadassah, she's just been a trooper through some of that. And
So she would just throw these massive fits. And we're like, you know, we're trying the Danny Silk stuff. Control yourself or I'm going to control you. Well, this is, you know, and trying to do some of that. And we were at Lave and Jennifer's. And Jennifer, his wife Jennifer, is like, she's like a grandma to our kids. And she has helped out a ton. They go to Bethel, Atlanta. And she's helped out a ton of parents and kind of a lot of people that moved to Atlanta were from Reading and different states. And so she's helped kind of parent and grandparent and just kind of be like a stable person in their lives and teach kids how to bake. And she's just like, she's just a fun grandma. So anyway, Hadassah was like throwing this massive fit. I don't know where you were. I think you were upstairs helping the girls get to bed. And Hadassah like throws this big fit. And so finally, I take her in the bedroom and I whoop her. I gave her the control thing and I whoop her. And then I leave her in her bed, shut the door. She's still throwing a fit. I come out and I thrive on affirmation. Like, it's just like, man, that was a good message. A good job. And like, oh, thanks. Thank you. So she's like, she comes over to me. She hugs me. She gives me a high five. She's like, way to go, Dad. Like that. I'm like, she's like, you actually spanked your kid. You know, and because she's seen so much of this, like this new thing of Danny Silk, and then some people take it to a stream. So she's like high fiving me and like hugging me, and I was like, yeah, I'm the man, you know. So again, it's learning your kids, and I will say we have to parent each one different. Hadassah has been spanked more in her first 3 years of life than any of our other three children put together. Olivia went through a stretch of about a year that she gave her a run for her money there for a little bit.
I would say one big key is how do you respond? How do you respond to everything? How do you respond when they argue with you? How do you respond when they tell you they did something wrong? How do you respond to their grades? How do you respond when they tell you something that someone told them that was naughty on the bus? It's so important how you respond. Because all it takes is one negative experience with your response, and they will shut down for the rest of their lives. And I don't want to have a 14-year-old involved in stuff and is not going to tell me things.
Yeah.
I mean, our biggest thing is we always talk about openness and honesty, and just the way in which we respond is so important. I have learned that just... I mean, I know our oldest is only 10, but I have learned that. And I think so far we have a very open, I feel like open back
dialogue
and forth with all of them.
Yeah.
You know, asking us questions and just...
Elaborate how you respond. Like, what's important, what's not.
So instead of freaking out when they tell you something that you would freak out inside about, you're freaking out. And instead of being like, why did you do that? You know, it's like... Okay. Thank you for sharing. How did that go? Or, you know, it's kind of like the Danny. How did that work out for you? That is the response I'm talking about. Because it just takes a second. That initial is going to... I'm like, you know, I have experiences from my past where the way I got yelled at when I said one thing, I'll never say things again. You know, and honestly, even like for him and I mean, it's the same thing in marriage. Like, he'll tell me something a certain way that he's feeling, and the way I lash back, he's like, I don't feel safe to ever talk to you about that again. And I'm like, you know, instantly you're like, I don't want that kind of a relationship. That's what I want with my kids. So that when they are 16 and they're at a party and something went down, they know that they can tell us and our response is going to feel safe. You know, it doesn't mean that we aren't going to correct it or there's not going to be consequence, but it's just, you know, so...
You know, one of the examples with that is, by the way, there's four books that I'd recommend. Loving Your Kids on Purpose, Danny Silk. Keep Your Love On.
Yeah.
This is for all ages, all relationships.
Yeah.
Like, not just for parents, but that's a really good book of boundaries and protecting those. Even with our time, you know, we can kind of use those bubbles. Frost, Jack Frost, has two incredible books, Spiritual Slavery to Spiritual Sonship and The Father's Embrace. You know, he just paints a good picture of the father's heart in some of this. How would the father react in these ways? He is a husband, as a groom, as the, you know, as God. How would he react to these things, to Nicole? But an example, Chloe, we've told our kids we would tell them everything. Like, we won't hold anything from you. We won't will always tell you the truth and will tell you everything you need to know. So we got into talking about sex and different things, and we've so Chloe came home in second grade, and she's like, so-and-so on the playground said sex is dancing with each other. Is that true? No, honey. Nope. Nope, that's not true at all. Sex is a beautiful thing that God created for a husband and a wife. Some people choose to have it sooner than that, but God's plan is for marriage and to save that for the for marriage. And so I said, we said, it is not that, but when, you know, we're going to tell you this much, and when you're older, if you have any other questions, you just ask us. So we waited a year, and we told her a little more, you know, or waited a little bit, told her a little more. Another circumstance came, we told her a little more. And then we're like, all right, this is the year. So we take our kids every year to dinner before the first night of their school or something, and we prophesy over them, get them a gift, and declare things, and pick a verse for each one of them for the school year. And we're like, all right, guys, Daddy's going to tell you about sex. And I get a knife out. I get the little ring that holds the napkin out. And I just go through the whole thing. This is what sex is. And they're all there. And I said, this is a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I think that we learned, though, through that circumstance with Chloe. I would rather her not have questions and come to us and has to ask us questions. Yeah. I would rather her already have known. And so that's why we have a 2-year-old, six at the time, 7-year-old, and then a 9-year-old, and we're explaining the whole thing to the 2-year-old, because I would rather them have that foundational first, that first thing that you learn to that, I want that to come from our mouth and not from the school bus or the playground. And so I don't want to be reactive, I want to be proactive.
Here's the other thing, what we learned, like my parents were like really open, and I probably learned way too much, heard way too many stories. But her parents were probably the opposite and talked about it when she was like 13, 14, and just talked about not to do it until marriage. So then what happens is you enter marriage, and then you have unequal expectations. And now what was meant to be a beautiful, great, fulfilling, amazing thing is now still almost feared, because now is this okay? You know, from her perspective and me, you know. So we also, like, painted the picture. It's really amazing. God gave this as a gift, and it's the greatest gift you can give your spouse on your wedding night. So we went into this whole thing, but we also made sure we elaborated how amazing it is. It's really good. And this, you know people that have babies and aren't married yet, and this is, they chose to do that. It doesn't please God. He still loves them, you know. We just go through the whole thing. And so we just felt like, Jake Hamilton kind of encouraged it, but we just felt like telling them everything. So Nicole's like, oh, wow, Aaron's doing this right now, right here.
At Cheddar's.
At the restaurant Cheddar's, out on the dining patio.
Out of nowhere. We didn't plan that. I didn't.
Just felt like the Lord told me to do it. So anyway, and then we said, if you ever have questions, you come to us. We'll tell you everything. And they have. There's been totally open dialogue. But what else? Yeah.
I think it was in the spring.
Yeah.
So that's the initial thing that they remember.
First person that tells you.
Yeah.
Is really important.
Yeah.
Where you hear it from first.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was emphasizing. That's
It's true.
Should have come from him.
Yeah, Chris Valentin, like if you have teenagers or even college age or just right before marriage age. The Moral Revolution stuff's really good. Is that what it's called, Moral Revolution? That's really good. And then there's a book that I recommend doing to just like premarital, like engagement couples, couples before sex, is I think it's called Between the Sheets or Sheet Music, something like that. Have you heard that?
Yes.
It's talking like, so when we do premarital counseling, we're like, we get really like honest. We're just like, oh, listen, if it's your first time, this is what to expect. This is, you know, I talk to the guys. I have a pep talk with the guys and just get pretty detailed. Not like, not unhealthily graphic, but like this is, so. It's random. So. If this was the millennials, I would have just kept going, but I'm not. Technically, yeah. We were born in 1980, so according to Wikipedia, that's the cutoff.
What happened to Y?
I'll say this. Nicole and I love millennials because they're offering something different of what needs to be offered. So I know they get a lot of slack of being, you know, no work ethic, loyalty, all these things that are negative and put downs. But they're wired the way they're wired because they need to reach a generation that needs to be reached by them. So they're wired like that because they need to reach a generation that's going to relate more to them than us. So we embrace it. We're just like, it's awesome. You invite me to lunch and I pay for it. It's awesome. God bless you. You're awesome. So, but no, we do pour into them though. We're just like, we affirm them so stinking much and we rub on them. They love it. Like affection and affirmation. Millennials love it. They want to be loved. They want to be accepted. They want to be heard. They want to be a part of something. Like this, interaction like this, oh, they thrive on it. It's a crazy thing. When we break them off into small groups, we can't separate them. We can't get them to stop talking. Crazy. Like here, we're like, okay, any other questions? Let's dream together. It's like, come on, let's pull. Millennials? When you get them into small groups, it's awesome.
I appreciate you sharing just a little bit about that.
Yeah.
It's real easy to develop a...
Yeah. Our world is going technical. It's going with technology, computers. That's what they're good at.
Yeah.
And what's crazy is you think they'd be wired opposite of what we think. They actually long for authentic relationships. They don't want to be in front of a screen anymore. They grew up that way. So they want the shopping experience. They don't like online shopping as much as we do.
Really?
Yeah. We're like, oh, yeah, Amazon, deliver it, Prime, done, 2 days. I'm not saying they don't do it. They drive that market. But like downtown shopping, old like small shopping with a purpose, all that stuff that gives purpose, that they love it. They love conversation. Like they thrive off of a cup of coffee with me, like or just in general, just that face to face. You would not think. You think they'd be texting more, but they actually long more for the face to face. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? It is 3:20, so.
Yeah, I think we're good. This has been awesome. Everything you shared is good. It's really nice. We don't do this enough where we just sit and talk, and we need to develop that more and actually allow for the make for the time. I mean, it's back to this concept of a family rather than keep doing meetings, you know?
Yeah.
And this is missing.
We probably have 300-400 solid people in our church if the faithful ones would show up at the same time, maybe up to 400. I would much rather have that of people who like each other and people who are willing to actually do a difficult conversation, even if it could be hard to share those feelings. I would much rather have that people who are hungry for his presence and than 3,000 or 4,000 people that just are trying to show up and get out of the parking lot before the next group comes. Like, we have to kick people out of our church. Like, okay, time to leave. I've been here an hour waiting for you guys to quit talking. You know, it's like, okay, we start doing, like, hints. Okay, we turn off those lights. Then we start to kind of, like, turn lights off to force them out the door. And then the narthex. And then I start to turn the narthex lights off. It's like, but I love it. Like, I know. So I'm just saying, like, for what we're talking about, and it works for us, I'm wired because I want authenticity,
you
know, and I'd much rather have 300 people like the mighty men that David had than thousands of people that may not go into battle with you. He doesn't need an army. He was going to turn the world upside down with 12 people.
Yeah.
He'll take an army, you know,
but...
So honored to be here. Thank you. Thank you.